Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. Continuing with Part 1, Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 5, The Ascent of the Sacrifice 1, The Works of Knowledge, the Psychic Being, page 134. This then is, in its foundations, the integral knowledge of the Supreme and Infinite, whom we offer our sacrifice. And this, the nature of the sacrifice itself in its triple character, a sacrifice of works, a sacrifice of love and adoration, a sacrifice of knowledge. For even when we speak of the sacrifice of works by itself, we do not mean the offering only of our outward acts, but of all that is active and dynamic in us, our internal movements no less than our external doings are to be consecrated on the one altar. The inner heart of all work that is made into a sacrifice is a labor of self-discipline and self-perfection by which we can hope to become conscious and luminous with a light from above poured into all our movements of mind, heart, will, sense, life, and body. An increasing light of divine consciousness will make us close in soul and one by identity in our inmost being and spiritual substance with the Master of the World Sacrifice. The supreme object of existence proposed by the ancient Vedanta, but also it will tend to make us one in our becoming by resemblance to the divine in our nature. The mystic sense of the symbol of sacrifice in the sealed speech of the seers of the Veda. But if this is to be the character of the rapid evolution from a mental being to a spiritual being contemplated by the integral yoga, a question arises, full of many perplexities, but of great dynamic importance. How are we to deal with life and works as they now are, with the activities proper to our still unchanged human nature? An ascension towards a greater consciousness, an occupation of our mind, life, and body by its powers, has been accepted as the outstanding object of the yoga. But still, life here, not some other life elsewhere, is proposed as the immediate field of the action of the spirit. A transformation, not an annihilation of our instrumental being and nature. Activities of the mind turn towards knowledge and the expression of knowledge. Activities of our emotional and sensational parts. Activities of outward conduct, creation, production. The will turned towards mastery over men, things, life, the world, the forces of nature. Are they to be abandoned and to be replaced by some other way of living in which a spiritualized consciousness can find its true expression and figure? Are they to be maintained as they are in their outward appearance, but transformed by an inner spirit in the act, or enlarged in scope and liberated into new forms by a reversal of consciousness, such as was seen on earth when man took up the vital activities of the animal to mentalize and extend and transfigure them by the infusion of reason, thinking will, refined emotion, and organized intelligence? Or is there to be an abandonment in part, a preservation only of such of them as can bear a spiritual change, and, for the rest, the creation of a new life expressive in its form no less than in its inspiration and motive force of the unity, wideness, peace, joy, and harmony of the liberated spirit? It is this problem, most of all, that has exercised the minds of those who have tried to trace the paths that lead from the human to the divine in the long journey of the yoga. Every kind of solution has been offered, from the entire abandonment of works and life so far as that is physically possible, to the acceptance of life as it is, but with a new spirit, animating and uplifting its movements, in appearance the same as they were, but changed in the spirit behind them, and therefore in their inner significance. The extreme solution insisted on by the world-shunning ascetic, or the inward-turned ecstatical and self-oblivious mystic, is evidently foreign to the purpose of an integral yoga. For if we are to realize the divine in the world, it cannot be done by leaving aside the world action and action itself altogether. At a less high pitch, it was laid down by the religious mind in ancient times that one should keep only such actions as are in their nature part of the seeking, service, or cult of the divine, and such others as are attached to these, or in addition, those that are indispensable to the ordinary setting of life, but done in a religious spirit, and according to the injunctions of traditional religion and scripture. But this is too formalist a rule for the fulfillment of the free spirit in works, and it is besides professedly no more than a provisional solution for tiding over the transition from life in the world to a life in the beyond, which still remains the sole ultimate purpose. An integral yoga must lean rather to the Catholic injunction of the Gita that even the liberated soul, living in the truth, should still do all the works of life, so that the plan of the universal evolution, under a secret divine leading, may not languish or suffer. But if all works are to be done with the same forms and on the same lines as they are now done in the ignorance, our gain is only inward, and our life is in danger of becoming the dubious and ambiguous formula of an inner light doing the works of an outer twilight. The perfect spirit expressing itself in a mold of imperfection foreign to its own divine nature. If no better can be done for a time, and during a long period of transition, something like this does inevitably happen, then so it must remain, till things are ready, and the spirit within is powerful enough to impose its own forms on the life of the body and the world outside. But this can be accepted only as a transitional stage, and not as our soul's ideal, or the ultimate goal of the passage. For the same reason, the ethical solution is insufficient. For an ethical rule merely puts a bit in the mouth of the wild horses of nature, and exercises over them a difficult and partial control. But it has no power to transform nature so that she may move in a secure freedom, fulfilling the intuitions that proceed from a divine knowledge. At best, its method is to lay down limits, to coerce the devil, to put the wall of a relative and very doubtful safety around us. This, or some similar device of self-protection, may be necessary for a time, whether in ordinary life or in yoga. But in yoga, it can only be the mark of a transition. A fundamental transformation and a pure wideness of spiritual life are the aim before us, and if we are to reach it, we must find a deeper solution, a surer supra-ethical dynamic principle. To be spiritual within, ethical in the outside life, this is the ordinary religious solution. But it is a compromise. The spiritualization of both the inward being and the outward life, and not a compromise between life and the spirit, is the goal of which we are the seekers. Nor can the human confusion of values, which obliterates the distinction between spiritual and moral, and even claims that the moral is the only true spiritual element in our nature, be of any use to us. For ethics is a mental control, and the limited erring mind is not and cannot be the free and ever-luminous spirit. It is equally impossible to accept the gospel that makes life the one aim, takes its elements fundamentally as they are, and only calls in a half-spiritual or pseudo-spiritual light to flush and embellish it. Inadequate, too, is the very frequent attempt at a misalliance between the vital and the spiritual. A mystic experience within, with an aestheticized intellectual and sensuous paganism or exalted hedonism outside, leaning upon it and satisfying itself in the glow of a spiritual sanction. For this, too, is a precarious and never successful compromise, and it is as far from the divine truth and its integrality as the puritanic opposite. These are all stumbling solutions of the fallible human mind, groping for a transaction between the high spiritual summits and the lower pitch of the ordinary mind motives and life motives. Whatever partial truth may be hidden behind them, that truth can only be accepted when it has been raised to the spiritual level, tested in the supreme truth consciousness, and extricated from the soil and error of the ignorance. In sum, it may be safely affirmed that no solution offered can be anything but provisional until a supramental truth consciousness is reached by which the appearances of things are put in their place and their essence revealed, and that in them which derives straight from the spiritual essence. In the meanwhile, our only safety is to find a guiding law of spiritual experience, or else to liberate a light within that can lead us on the way until that greater direct truth consciousness is reached above us or born within us. For all else in us that is only outward, all that is not a spiritual sense or seeing, the constructions, representations, or conclusions of the intellect, the suggestions or instigations of the life force, the positive necessities of physical things are sometimes half-lights, sometimes false lights, that can at best only serve for a while or serve a little, and for the rest either detain or confuse us. The guiding law of spiritual experience can only come by an opening of human consciousness to the divine consciousness. There must be the power to receive in us the working and command and dynamic presence of the divine Shakti and surrender ourselves to her control. It is that surrender and that control which bring the guidance. But the surrender is not sure. There is no absolute certitude of the guidance so long as we are besieged by mind formations and life impulses and instigations of ego which may easily betray us into the hands of a false experience. This danger can only be countered by the opening of a now 9/10 concealed inmost soul or psychic being that is already there, but not commonly active within us. That is the inner light we must liberate. For the light of this inmost soul is our one sure illumination, so long as we walk still amidst the siege of the ignorance and the truth consciousness has not taken up the entire control of our Godward endeavor. The working of the divine force in us under the conditions of the transition and the light of the psychic being turning us always towards a conscious and seeing obedience to that higher impulsion and away from the demands and instigations of the forces of the ignorance, these between them create an ever-progressive inner law of our action, which continues until the spiritual and supramental can be established in our nature. In the transition, there may well be a period in which we take up all life and action and offer them to the divine for purification, change, and deliverance of the truth within them. Another period in which we draw back and build a spiritual wall around us, admitting through its gates only such activities as consent to undergo the law of the spiritual transformation. A third, in which a free and all-embracing action, but with new forms fit for the utter truth of the Spirit, can again be made possible. These things, however, will be decided by no mental rule, but in the light of the soul within us, and by the ordaining force and progressive guidance of the divine power that secretly or overtly first impels, then begins clearly to control and order, and finally takes up the whole burden of the yoga. In accordance with the triple character of the sacrifice, we may divide works, too, into a triple order. The works of knowledge, the works of love, the works of the will in life, and see how this more plastic spiritual rule applies to each province and affects the transition from the lower to the higher nature.